Hi there, it's Ed here with a short message before we start the pod this week. Did you know that our most informed investors get insights, articles, and investment ideas from Tom, me, and the team sent directly to them via email, and it is completely free. You can join them. Just subscribe at fidelity.co.uk/newsletters. Hello and welcome to the Personal Investor Podcast. I'm Ed Monk. Today on the show, with a new government imminent, what does it mean that inflation is now back on target, especially at a time when rates remain high? Will cash continue to grow its appeal to investors, and can wage rises help undo the damage from the cost of living crisis? That's all up for discussion today. If you enjoy the show, please rate us, share us, or leave a comment wherever you get your podcasts. Whichever party wins the election, a new parliament will begin on July the 5th, and whoever's in charge will need to quickly survey the economic landscape. Some of the things they're going to be hoping for include inflation remaining on target and for interest rates to start to fall. Last week brought updates on progress on both those things. Inflation is now back on target at 2% after another fall in price rises, but any hope that this would lead to a cut in rates was quickly quashed when the Bank of England confirmed no change in borrowing costs. So what will the first few months of a new parliament hold from an economic point of view? Will a new government receive a golden inheritance or a poisoned chalice as reward for winning the election? To answer that, I'm joined by Tom Stevenson, Investment Director here at Fidelity. Tom, welcome along. Let's start with those numbers from last week, shall we? It's surely noteworthy that inflation is now back on target, but there hasn't been much by the way of fanfare about it. Why was that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really is noteworthy. I mean, if you go back to October of 2022, inflation in the UK was running at over 11%. We were a real outlier. We were performing much worse on the inflation front than our peers in the US and in Europe and in many other places as well. And we are now, just over 18 months later, back to target at 2%, which is what was announced last week, dead on, 2.0%. Mm-hmm. And we are the first major economy to get back to the central bank target. So, you know, I think it is quite an achievement. It is quite a moment. You're absolutely right, though, not a huge amount of fanfare accompanied that figure. And I think the reason for that was that you didn't have to scratch too far beneath the surface to see some slightly more worrying inflationary signals. So a couple of things jump out. The service sector inflation, which is, you know, the bigger part of the UK economy, is still running at 5.7%. So that's way ahead of the 2% target. And one of the reasons why service sector inflation is running high is because it is influenced a lot by wages, and wage inflation is still running at about 6% in the UK. So I think that's what the central banks are looking at. And of course, what happened the following day was that the Bank of England left interest rates unchanged. And I think the reason for that was that they were focused on those wage and service sector inflation figures.
Yeah, which always slightly begs the question, well, you know, if the bank's so bothered about services and wages, why don't they make that the target rather than CPI, which actually is on target? But I suppose it's all contextual, isn't it? And what they're trying to do is restrict the economy. And in the wages data and the services data, you've got signs of lots of sort of inflationary pressure that were they to cut too early, could see inflation rise again. In fact, predictions are that inflation will rise again.
That's exactly right. And the reason why inflation will probably rise again is because these things work on an annual cycle, and things will drop out of the year-on-year comparisons. And the things which have driven inflation lower, so falls in energy costs, and in particular falls in food costs, will start to level out. Mm. And then, you know, when you don't get that goods inflation downward driver, then the relatively high wage inflation, the relatively high service sector inflation starts to become a problem.
Yeah, and you mentioned the Bank of England. Obviously, it kept rates at 5.25%. No one was surprised by that because we're in the middle of an election campaign, so it would have been deemed too political. I wonder why that matters these days. If you're either independent or you're not, and perhaps shouldn't take care of
I think that's right. I think probably more significant than the potential for looking to be, you know, influencing the election was the fact that because there's an election coming up, the Bank of England enters this sort of purdah where it can't actually talk, it can't have press conferences, and so it would have been quite difficult for it to explain why it had changed tack on inflation. And for the sake of a month, I can see why they held back.
But they held a vote, and 7 of the 9 MPC members voted to hold again. That's a sort of no change from last month. Did we learn anything about the direction from rates? Maybe not from what the bank said, but for the market's interpretation of it, any other indications about the direction for rates and when they might fall?
Well, I think that the direction of travel is downwards. I think that, you know, everyone, you know, I think the Bank of England is running out of reasons not to cut interest rates. One of the things which, of course, is holding it back is that central banks don't operate in isolation from other central banks. And of course, the key central bank here is the Federal Reserve, the US central bank, which is sitting on its hands, holding back from cutting interest rates. And that makes it very difficult for other banks to cut, even if they would quite like to, principally because of the impact on the exchange rate. So if that differential widens between the level of interest rates in the US, and of course they're actually marginally higher in the US than they are here, they're between 5.25% and 5.5%. If that differential widens, then all other things being equal, the exchange rate will fall, the value of the pound against the dollar will fall. So banks have to be cognizant of that when they're making the decisions.
Yeah, and all this means, Tom, that rates are, of course, above inflation. That's actually been the case since October last year, I found. I've been looking at some numbers this week about the relationship between rates and inflation. And as of last week, given that inflation fell to 2%, rates are 5.25%, that's the biggest difference that we've had, the biggest excess of rates above inflation since the start of 2008. So before, in fact, the financial crisis, because there was lots of monetary policy changes as the financial crisis played out. But that was when rates were still high before that really hit. So you can see, as I've done this week, I've plotted these out in chart form. You can really see the last, 16, almost 17 years of abnormal economic conditions, rates being really, really, really low, and us being very, very used to inflation being higher than interest rates. That's basically been the situation for all those years. Is it possible now to say that we're past that and that we're now going to have more normal conditions, kind of like the old or the new old normal, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the right word to use, normal, because, you know, you could argue that the last 15 years or so have been an anomaly. Now, they've been an extremely long anomaly, and it's been such a long anomaly that for many people, it has become their new normality. Mm. But the reality is that you would expect interest rates and yields, bond yields, cash yields, to be higher than inflation. That is why that's what persuades an investor to buy a yield, because, you know, the enemy of fixed income investing is inflation, and so you need to be compensated for the fact that, you know, that your fixed income is going to be eroded by inflation over time. So the way that markets do that is by pricing the bonds, by pricing the yield in excess of inflation in a normal
otherwise
environment.
Otherwise, no one buys.
Now, no one's going to buy them, and that will then push the yields higher. In practice, what's happened over the last 15 years is that we've had this extremely unusual world where rates and yields have been kept artificially low in order to stimulate a low growth economy.
And lots of artificial bond buying in various ways.
That's right. Central banks have stepped in as a buyer of last resort to create that situation. But it's not the normal situation. So I don't know the answer to your question. I don't know whether we have returned to a new normality, but I rather suspect we have. And And that's good news, actually. It's good news for savers and investors, because you are being rewarded, finally, after many years, you're being rewarded for taking that inflation risk, for taking that investment risk.
Well, it feels, I mean, this is the I'm writing about this, and that's why I've been looking at these numbers. And when you say, oh, you know, you can get a return on cash, we're talking about the Bank of England rates, but even cash rates are above 5% if in some scenarios. And it almost feels like a kind of cheat code for having a return on your cash that far above inflation, which is at 2%. But of course, as you say, that's how it's supposed to be. But we're just so unused to it. And so I wanted to turn the conversation to what this means, given the election is going on. What kind of inheritance will, well, any flavour of government after July 5th, at the moment, at point of recording, that's expected, according to the polls, to be a Labour government. What will they inherit by way of the economic landscape?
Well, I think they inherit a difficult economic landscape, but you would not really recognise that fact from the conversation that's been had in the run-up to the election. Because, you know, neither of the main parties has really been candid, I would say, about the difficult choices which face the economy. The reality is that the British economy has relatively sluggish growth. It has poor productivity and has done for many years. Borrowings are extremely high because of money that was spent, first of all, during the financial crisis, and then, of course, during COVID. The reality is that as a country, you know, we desire to have European-style public services and American-style taxes. And that is not realistic. You know, yeah. We can't have both. That means that we have to make difficult choices. The politicians have to make difficult choices. But the reality of the electoral system is that you don't get elected by being honest about those political choices.
Yeah, there's an organisation called the Institute for Fiscal Studies. I'm sure listeners will be familiar with it. They said they've called it a conspiracy of silence between the parties, because it's not really in anyone's interests to say exactly, to acknowledge those difficult trade-offs. You mentioned borrowing's very high, so it makes it hard to borrow more. Tax is very high, the tax burden is at an historically high level. Now, maybe that doesn't mean anything. Maybe you just tax more. I don't know. But in an election where it seems that people are complaining about the standard of public services, the kind of public realm crumbling, all this stuff, and you want to do something about that, something's got to give, right?
Yeah.
And this is what the critics have said. That's the gloomy side of it. Could you not make the argument, Tom, given everything else that we've just been saying, that wages are rising much faster than inflation? That makes people richer in real terms. That makes workers richer. That's a really important thing that's happening. That will make people feel better. Savers can get a higher return on their cash. Rates are very, very high, which is tough if you're a borrower, but the next direction is supposed to be lower, so that's going to make people feel better. And rates being high also has a dampening effect on the housing market, and I'm not sure these days whether that's a bad thing. I think it's a good thing, and I think more and more people recognise it as a good thing that we don't want runaway house prices. So there's a version of this from a kind of household finance point of view where people might feel a bit better. If you're into the growth figures and the productivity figures, not so much.
Yes, but the two, of course, are connected, and I think you're right. I don't think it's sort of, you know, too Pollyanna-ish to look at that positive outlook, because actually we need that positive outlook if we're going to get out of the negative situation which I described. Because the only way that we're going to square the circle between our spending aspirations and our, you know, taxing reality is by creating growth, and that is what, and that's why the Labour Party has made the centrepiece of their manifesto really the generation of economic growth. Now, whether they're going to achieve it or not is another question, but you can see why they want to achieve growth, because you can't cut your way to prosperity. You know, you ultimately you have to grow your economy, and if people are getting progressively richer because their wages are rising faster than inflation, and if they're able to generate money on their savings, etc., then that is a positive for growth. And so I think that is a good thing. So I think we face very severe challenges as an economy, but I'm not negative at all.
And just finally, Tom, we're not here really to run through the proposed tax changes here, but there's been lots of kind of calming words from Labour. They are expected to win. They've spoken about the big three taxes, VAT, income tax, national insurance, which they will not put up. They are not the only taxes that exist, so probably that we should expect some, if they win, of course, some movement on those things. There's CGT, there's inheritance tax, there's a million levers to pull within the tax system.
Yeah. I mean, they've been pretty careful about how they've phrased things. They've said there are no current plans and that there's no need on our sums don't require us to, you know, but they've very carefully not ruled out some of those taxes that you mentioned. Capital gains tax, I think, is you know, must be in their sights. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of things that they can do with capital gains tax which don't necessarily require them to go the whole hog and align capital gains taxes, which are lower than income taxes, with income taxes. You know, there are a couple of levels of capital gains tax, one for property, one for other investments. They may align those. So there are measures that they can take. And I think, you know, we have to be realistic. We are going to see taxes go up, but we just don't know exactly the shape of that.
And they haven't, well, that I've seen, haven't given a very, very clear answer on this tax threshold freeze question. Would it break the manifesto promise if that freeze was extended by a year? I don't know. In 2 or 3 years' time, they could say, well, you know, we're going to have to extend this from 2030 to 2031. Who knows? You know, that would recoup more money. It's been very effective for the government.
And that's the reality. The reality is, if they want to really move the dial with taxes, fiddling around with something like capital gains tax is not going to do it. They have to address the big taxes, which is, you know, income tax, VAT, national insurance, and they have to work out how to do that in a way that doesn't blow their manifesto promises out of the water, doesn't alienate the voting population.
Okay, well, by the time listeners hear us next, Tom, the election may well be over, depending how our week goes next week. But for this week, that is all the time we have for now. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Ed.
Please note that the value of investments and the income from them can go down as well as up, so you may get back less than you invest. Investors should note that the views expressed may no longer be current and may have already been acted upon. This information is not a personal recommendation for any particular investment. If you are unsure about the suitability of an investment, you should speak to one of Fidelity's advisors or an authorised financial advisor of your choice. Overseas investments will be affected by movements in currency exchange rates, and investments in emerging markets can be more volatile than other more developed markets. Reference to the specific securities should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell these securities and is included for the purposes of illustration only. Tax treatment depends on individual circumstances and all tax rules may change in the future. Withdrawals from a pension product may not be possible until you reach age 55, 57 from 2028. This podcast may not be reproduced or circulated without prior permission. No statements or representations made in this podcast are legally binding on Fidelity or the recipient. This podcast is meant only for UK residents and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation in any jurisdiction in which it may be unlawful to make such an offer or solicitation.